indicated that they were both for her. Just trying to lighten the mood. Well, stop. He smiled reassuringly while he watched Grisha Azarov get out of his truck and start walking up behind her. The fact that he wasn't alone was a good sign. He and Kara Hansen had been virtually inseparable since he'd resigned from the service of Russia's president. She was a 30-year-old American surf instructor with the expected athletic figure, unkempt blonde hair, and perpetual half-sunburn. Her barely perceptible smile looked both permanent and entirely sincere. By all reports, she was adored by everyone who knew her, and it wasn't hard to see why. "Hola, Isabella," she said as they stepped onto the deck. "Podemos sentarnos al lado de las flores?" Rapp understood enough to know that Azarov wasn't dictating where they sat, and that the table near the flowers, while a great spot for an early dinner, was a tactical death trap. Claudia stiffened, but managed not to look back.
"Is that them?"
"Uh-huh."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I didn't want you to spill your drink on your funeral dress."
"You're so funny. Maybe comedy was your calling, no?"
He just smiled, ignoring Kara and Azarov as they ordered drinks. After a convincing interval, the Russian looked directly at him and whispered something in his companion's ear. A moment later, they were up and walking in Rapp's direction. Claudia seemed to think it was a good time to finish her second glass of wine and get a firm grip on her third.
"Mitch?"
"Grisha," Rapp said, feigning surprise as he stood and shook the man's hand. "What are you doing here?"
"I live only a few kilometers away."
"Really? I had no idea." Azarov turned toward Kara.
"I'd like you to meet Mitch. We know each other from Saudi Arabia."
"Hi," she said, extending a hand. "I'm Kara. So you're in the oil business, too?"
"I am." They had actually met once before. It had been dark, though, and he'd had a silencer pressed to her boyfriend's head. It'd be interesting to know how Azarov had explained that one away. "And this is Claudia," the Russian said. She twitched visibly at the fact that he knew who she was, but managed to look reasonably relaxed as they exchanged greetings. Her B-plus grade moved to a tentative A-minus.
"Have you been on the trail behind the restaurant yet?" Azarov asked.
His accent had softened noticeably, taking on a bit of the Spanish that surrounded him.
"I haven't," Claudia responded. "Why don't you take her on a tour, Kara?"
"Sure. The toucans are usually out this time of the afternoon. Grab your wine. It's easy walking."
Rapp watched the two women descend from the deck and disappear into the jungle.
"May I join you?" Azarov asked.
"Please." They sat, and Rapp took the opportunity to examine the man. The cuts from the glass that had shattered in his face were long healed, and whatever scars remained were obscured by his tan. He'd put on a few pounds, taking the edge off the gaunt, professional endurance athlete look he'd had before. Rounding out his new, softer image was a blonde head of hair, about the same shade as Scott Coleman's. Most of the change, though, wasn't physical. The man was extraordinarily talented and well-trained, but had lived most of his adult life as little more than a slave to Maxim Krupin. Now he looked happy. In fact, he looked happy enough to make Rapp wonder if he'd made a mistake coming there.
"Vacation," Azarov said, sipping an ice water. "Or have you managed to bring in a team that I missed?"
"No team. Just us."
"Why? You've had two opportunities to kill me, and you've taken neither. I assume your people are watching me, and if that's the case, you know I'm no longer in contact with the Russian government."
It was true as far as anyone had been able to tell. Azarov's first order of business after divesting of most of the foreign property that he no longer needed was learning to surf. The fact that he'd been an Olympic-level biathlete and was sleeping with a full-time instructor hadn't hurt. With the exception of a run-in with three territorial Hawaiian locals, one of whom was still relearning how to walk, his pursuit of the sport had gone spectacularly. Recently, though, he'd reconnected with the successful consulting company he'd used as a cover operation, appointing a new CEO and taking over as chairman of the board. It wasn't a particularly demanding position, but it also wasn't one he in any way needed. As far as the agency could tell, he had a net worth of more than $100 million and spent less than $2,000 of it every month. Rapp's silence caused the Russian to become wary.
I trust your friend Scott Coleman is still doing well.
Yeah, should be back in a year or so. That's not why I'm here.
What, then?
How's the quiet life? Rapp asked, not yet ready to answer the man's question.
I enjoy it. I enjoy my time with Kara. The freedom. And how about you? I have to admit that, based on your history together, a relationship with Claudia Gould is surprising.
Sometimes you have to let things go.
An enlightened attitude, but not one I would have ascribed to Mitch Rapp.
How is her daughter? Anna, isn't it?
After your late wife.
She must be what, 6?
7.
Ah, he said noncommittally, and then took another sip of his drink.
So, Rapp said, glancing behind him to make sure Kara hadn't reappeared, you wouldn't be interested in a small side job. Azarov's initial surprise was obvious, but then he gave an understanding nod.
I took out the head of your backup team. You need a replacement, and you feel I owe you.
No. I've gotten tangled up in something Scott and his boys can't be involved in.
I see. And if I say no?
Then we'll have dinner, and I doubt we'll ever see each other again.
Azarov looked past him at the clouds building on the horizon.
How long?
A few weeks. Certainly no longer than a month.
Details?
There's someone I want to talk to.
Can I assume that he doesn't want to talk to you?
Safe assumption.
But your government doesn't agree about the importance of you meeting with this person.
Fair to say.
Not a personal vendetta, though. That would be something you'd handle yourself.
I'm looking forward to the conversation, Rapp said honestly, but the goal here isn't personal satisfaction.
I'm intrigued.
Payment? Rapp shrugged. I can offer you a lot of money. But the most expensive thing you bought in the last 6 months was a new board.
Azarov's brow furrowed, considering the issue.
U.S. citizenship?
Sure. But it'd be easier to just make Kara an honest woman and get it that way. Besides, you live in Costa Rica. Why pay the taxes?
True. But I think we would agree that someone with my skill set shouldn't be expected to work for free.
Rapp pulled out his wallet, extracted a single dollar, and laid it on the table. The Russian stared at it for a few seconds, finally reaching out and stuffing it in his pocket.
But you're picking up the dinner bill.
Chapter 21. Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. The phone on Ali Nassar's desk buzzed and he snatched it up.
Yes.
Ali, how are you? King Faisal said. Are you all right?
Nassar let out a relieved breath. Perhaps premature, but at least the waiting was over. He'd called the palace multiple times since his return to Riyadh, only to be told that the king was indisposed. Generally, these periodic breaks in communication were the result of the man's failing health. But that had now become a dangerous assumption. Had Faisal been avoiding calls because he'd heard about the disastrous meeting with President Alexander? Had he been made aware of the Americans' suspicions regarding Talal bin Musaid?
I'm well, Your Majesty. And you?
Me? Let's not speak of me.
I'm told that you suffered serious injuries defending yourself against those cowards in Mauritania.
I assure you that the reports have been wildly exaggerated. In fact, They had been entirely fabricated. The story was that Nassar had been drawn personally into a desperate fight with the terrorists. Accounts of his heroics were beginning to cross the line into the improbable, but no one had any reason to question them.
Exaggerated. Modesty doesn't suit you, Ali. The terrorists themselves are corroborating accounts of your actions.
Mullah Halabi's doing, of course. The fact that the ISIS leader was already using his influence to increase Nassar's stature in Saudi Arabia was an encouraging sign.
I did only what was necessary, Your Highness.
The king laughed.
Well, Ali, if this is too trivial a matter for you to discuss, why don't you tell me about your meeting with the president?
Nassar actually smiled at that. The old man hadn't heard. Perhaps Nassar's initial analysis had been correct. President Alexander was indeed too spineless to pursue the matter.
It turned out to be much more difficult even than the attack, Majesty.
What?
How so?
Nassar allowed for an appropriately dramatic pause, given the news he was about to deliver. The Americans believe that Talal bin Musaid recently went to Morocco to make a payment to ISIS.
What are you talking about?
That's outrageous, the king said, before descending into a coughing fit. It was violent enough that Nassar wondered if the old fool was finally going to drop dead. Unfortunately, Faisal managed to regain his breath.
Is there any truth to this, Ali?
In my opinion, there is not, Majesty. The accusation relies entirely on the account of a single mercenary and a laughably poor photograph. While it's true that the prince was in Morocco at the time, I've spoken to his security people and embassy personnel, all of whom are willing to testify that he was nowhere near the site of the alleged exchange.
Have you spoken to him? Have you spoken directly to Talal?
I haven't, Majesty.
I'll summon him to the palace immediately.
It was the expected reaction, but a potentially disastrous one. What were the chances that the idiot prince wouldn't let something slip under questioning?
Sir, I'd strongly recommend against that. Given some time, I believe I can prove his innocence to the Americans. And if that's the case, the entire matter will go away without anyone ever knowing about it.
I'm not convinced, Ali. President Alexander wouldn't make this kind of an accusation lightly.
I agree, Majesty. He's an impressive and thoughtful man, but not infallible.
If I'm wrong, and my investigation doesn't clear the prince beyond a shadow of a doubt, then he should be called upon to explain himself. But why humiliate him with an accusation that I'm convinced is false?
Faisal didn't immediately respond, but Nassar could hear his ragged breathing on the other end of the line.
You've never failed me before, Ali. And your heroism in Mauritania has once again demonstrated that you were the right man to oversee our intelligence efforts. I'll do as you advise. I'll wait for your report.
Thank you, Majesty. Faisal disconnected the call, and Nassar leaned back in his chair. The conversation had gone as well as could be hoped. He had time to carefully consider the problem that bin Musaid posed, and how to best solve it. Further, at this point, it was unlikely that the Americans would contact the king to protest the tone of Nassar's meeting with the president. But if they did, he could always excuse his performance by citing the shock he'd felt at a royal being the target of such an accusation. There was a knock on his office door, and a moment later the bearded face of Maya Zaman peeked around the jamb.
I hear you're off the line with the king. Do you have a moment to speak with a common peasant like myself?
Nassar's parents had been servants in the Zaman household, and because he and Maya were the same age, the two of them had struck up a friendship. They'd attended the same madrasa in their youth, and it was Maya's father who had recommended Nassar for the university scholarship program created by the king. Maya and Nassar continued their lifelong friendship, rooming together at Oxford and exploring Europe during school breaks. Upon their return to Saudi Arabia, Nassar had joined the military, the best way for the son of a working-class father to move up in society, and Zaman had taken over his family's wildly profitable construction company. Despite their divergent paths, the friendship endured.
"You look healthier than I expected," Zaman said as Nassar came around his desk to embrace the man. "It was nothing."
"Nothing? I read that you were forced to jump onto an armored vehicle and kill those dogs yourself. Praise Allah that you escaped with your life."
Nassar indicated for his friend to sit and then took the chair next to him. The office door was closed, but still he scooted close so that they could speak in whispers.
"Once again, I must ask for your help, Maya."
Zaman's expression turned conspiratorial.
"You know that I am always at your service, and at the service of God."
The lessons of the madrasa had influenced Zaman even more than they had Nassar. He had remained devout, but his life of privilege had left him yearning for something more meaningful than the acquisition of more and more wealth. Like Prince bin Musaid, this nagging emptiness made him useful. But the analogy ended there. Whereas the prince was a spoiled boy in the throes of a tantrum, Zaman was strong, devoted, and clever. Those qualities made him an effective soldier, but also made it necessary for Nassar to tell him more than he would have liked. Zaman was not a man who would tolerate being a simple pawn, and his intelligence allowed only the most careful lies. "Fortunately, while critical, it's not a complicated matter." Zaman nodded.
"What then?"
"We need to make another cash payment."
"Where?"
"Brussels. You'll take the money in your private plane, transfer it to a car, and then drive to a designated location in the Molenbeek neighborhood. And after that, nothing. That's the end of your involvement. Take the keys and leave. The car will be driven away a few hours later. No face-to-face contact will be necessary."
"Cameras?"
"No coverage where you'll leave the vehicle."
"How much?"
€5 million.
Zaman was surprised by the amount.
€5 million? Does this mean that you've made contact with Mullah Halabi?"
"I have," Nassar admitted.
"Excellent. And do you think your new relationship will bear fruit?"
"Perhaps."
In fact, it already had. Beyond the ISIS-generated story about his superhuman actions during the Mauritania attack, there had already been a quantifiable reduction in anti-monarchy sentiment on social media. After the €5 million was transferred, Nassar expected the rate of that reduction to accelerate. It was a strategy that worked on two levels. His fabricated heroics played well with the general population, and the attenuation of anti-royal internet bile played well with the king.
"Will it be used in an attack against the Americans?"
"I can't be certain, but that would be my assumption."
Zaman grinned. "I wouldn't be surprised to see you as caliph one day. The leader of lands that stretch from Mali to Tajikistan. If Allah calls on me to fill that role, I will of course do his will."
Zaman slapped him on the shoulder.
"Always so smooth, Ali. Those English girls at school never had a chance."
Chapter 22. Outside of Chicago, USA. Donatella Rahn moved through the alleyway, carefully avoiding puddles swollen from the rain. Her long dark hair was piled under a hat, and she wore sunglasses that obscured a face that had at one time made her a great deal of money. She maneuvered around a cascade of water coming from a broken gutter and took an opportunity to glance behind her. While the rain had done a good job of clearing the streets of pedestrians, there was no reason to be exposed any longer than absolutely necessary. Savoring the moment, while tempting, was a mistake made only by amateurs. She slipped into a shallow alcove and pressed her back against the dirty bricks. The rain was coming harder now, obscuring her field of view more than she'd anticipated. On the positive side, it worked both ways. In the unlikely event that someone saw her, they would only register a vague human outline taking refuge from the storm. At the center of the alley, she could see her victim huddled next to a dumpster. The man with him flicked a lighter to life, and its flame glinted off a spoon used to prepare the drugs they had scored that afternoon. Having spent much of her youth doing similar things behind similar dumpsters, she knew how long it would take, the procedure, and the necessary paraphernalia. Not that it mattered. The drugs weren't what she was there for. And that begged the question, why was she here? For so many years she'd led a charmed life. Italian runway model, Mossad assassin, private contractor. She'd killed terrorists, well-trained enemy soldiers, and captains of industry. She'd been respected, sought after, and feared by peers, by governments, and by the world's billionaire aristocracy. Now she was getting drenched, stalking a filthy and meaningless little creature named Jimmy Gatton. He was a drug addict, small-time dealer, and hustler, none of which was of any concern to her. It was his work as a petty thief that had attracted her attention. 3 weeks ago, she had returned to the home that had been forced on her and found it torn apart. Her stereo, television, and laptop were gone. The contents of every cabinet and drawer was strewn across the floor, as was the contents of her refrigerator. Donatella's anger had flared, but only briefly. None of it was really hers. None of it meant anything. Besides, it wasn't like she hadn't been involved in similar jobs to feed a similar habit when she was young. She'd begun walking from room to room, picking up the necessities that made existence possible. Pants, a toothbrush, a thermostat ripped from the wall, and leaving the rest. As she continued, she began to feel an increasing queasiness in the pit of her stomach. The job was sloppy and unnecessarily destructive, but there was also a strange thoroughness. She made her way into the master bedroom, feeling her stomach tighten further. As expected, her closet door was open and its contents shoveled onto the carpet. Not expected, though, was the open door to a hidden storage room at the back. The latch had been hacked away with a meat cleaver that was now stuck in the drywall. Donatella had frozen, her mouth suddenly going dry. When she finally managed to begin inching forward again, her horror grew with every step. The magnificent designer clothes and shoes, most made specifically for her in her previous life, weren't just discarded like the other things in the house, but utterly destroyed. The thief, after working so hard to get inside the secret room, had undoubtedly expected far greater treasure. Jewels, weapons, art, perhaps even drugs. Instead, he found decade-old Valentino, Gucci, and Louis Vuitton. In his rage, he'd torn them apart, and judging by the smell, urinated on them. She'd stared down at all that was left of who she once was, and, for the first time since her homeless teenage years, felt like she was fading away. How much more of this could she endure before she disappeared altogether? Donatella remembered looking up at the cleaver, suddenly mesmerized by its polished surface. She kept it razor sharp, as she had always done with her blades. Was that the answer? She didn't know how long she'd pondered that question, but like so many times before, her rage had saved her. It wouldn't end like this, not after everything she'd been through in her life. She'd survived Mitch Rapp abandoning her to the FBI's witness protection program. She'd survived being imprisoned in bland suburban hellhole after bland suburban hellhole. She'd even survived a few brief experiments with honest work. Hell, if she'd let a petty thief break her. After another quick scan of her operating environment, Donatella stepped from the alcove and started through the rain toward the center of the alley. It wouldn't be long before the drugs being prepared would go from spoon to vein, and she wanted to make sure that Gatton experienced what was to come with perfect clarity. The two men glanced up as she appeared from the mist, confused at first, and then intrigued. Gatton was the first to stand, moving to block her path. His hair was matted, but his features were immediately recognizable from his mugshot. The police had been largely uninterested in the break-in, and she certainly couldn't go to her FBI handlers. They would be furious to discover that she'd been clinging to mementos from a past that they'd worked so hard to eradicate. So Donatella resorted to the power she'd always had over men to get a local detective to admit that he knew who had done the job. Over drinks, in an intimate little restaurant, he'd been eminently understanding, sympathizing with her sense of violation, but explaining that he didn't have evidence that would stand up in court. In the end, his advice was to take the insurance payout and move on.
"You're a pretty lady," Gatton said.
The rain swallowed the sound to the point that no one outside of the alley would hear him, even if he shouted, even if he screamed. She angled to get around him, but he sidestepped and once again blocked her path. His companion was still crouched behind the dumpster, paying only partial attention. The drugs were what he cared about.
"What have you got in your hand?" he said,
pointing to the 8-inch cylinder clutched between perfectly manicured nails.
"Maybe something I want?"
Gatton had obviously made the same calculation that she had. What happened in this alley would stay in this alley. He took a step toward her.
"I bet you got a lot of things I want."
Donatella pressed the button on the spring-loaded baton, extending it to its full length. Gatton didn't even flinch. People were typically slow to process things that were utterly unexpected, and he was slower than most. She swung the weapon, slamming it into his ribs instead of going for the more obvious headshot. His grunt was audible through the roar of the rain, as was the satisfying snap of collapsing bone. He staggered right and she spun, swinging the baton hard enough into the back of his legs to take his feet out from under him. His face twisted in pain when he hit the wet asphalt, but he couldn't take in enough air to make a sound. In her peripheral vision, she saw Gatton's companion pull a knife from his pocket. She turned and met his wide-eyed gaze with a dead one of her own. His confusion was even deeper than Gatton's had been. The fact that she had a weapon and had used it to defend herself would be comprehensible, but her refusal to run for the safety of the street would be completely unfamiliar.
"Do we have business together?" she said, just loud enough for him to hear.
Apparently they didn't, because he just gathered up his drug paraphernalia and fled. Donatella shook off her umbrella and entered the parking garage. Her heart rate was still slightly elevated, but that was all that remained of what had happened. Her hair was still perfectly arranged, her makeup was unblemished, and her clothes were free of both wrinkles and blood. She slipped into the gray Ford Focus the FBI had given her, out of spite, she assumed, and inserted the key in the ignition. She started to turn it, but then froze when a gun was pressed to her ear by someone in the back seat. A cop? Could she have been seen? If that was the case, what should she do? Killing the man would be a trivial matter, but it wouldn't play well with her FBI handlers. No. What was she thinking? Police didn't hide in back seats waiting for a suspect to get in their car. A former enemy? Doubtful. As odious an organization as the FBI was, it had hidden her identity quite competently. A mugger? A rapist? That would be interesting. After all this time, two men in one day. What the fuck was that all about? Despite the years, the voice was immediately recognizable. "Mitch," she said, turning slowly.
You didn't answer my question.
He stole from me,
Donatella said. The anger that had faded long ago erupted again.
Like you did.
She pushed the gun aside and lunged over the seat, wrapping her hands around his neck and squeezing with everything she had.
You did this to me, you bastard. I had beautiful men, beautiful women, a beautiful flat in Milan. I am what you made me.
He dislodged her hands and shoved her back against the dashboard hard enough to knock the wind out of her. You did this to yourself, Donatella. How many times has the Bureau had to relocate you? Twice now? And from what I just saw, you're going for a hat trick.
What are you doing here, Mitch? You don't care about me. You haven't for a long time.
That's not true when you know it. But damn, you're a pain in the ass. Are you going to send me to Iowa? It was the FBI's favorite threat. And after what had happened 2 years ago in Dallas, they'd made it clear that it was no longer an idle one. He shook his head. I have a job you might be interested in.
A butcher shop that needs a new manager.
You're never going to let that go, are you? It was just a suggestion. You like food, and you're good with knives. His phone rang, and he put it to his ear. No, the alley north of that.
Uh-huh. I don't give a shit. Bury him in the woods, feed him to some pigs, just get rid of him.
Yeah. One, but he doesn't seem like the type he's gonna go to the cops.
Forget him.
I know she is.
I already said I owe you. What more do you want?
Fine. He disconnected the call.
Where were we?
You were talking about a job, she said, her eyes narrowing slightly. Why would you be coming to me? Is this something Scott and his Boy Scouts can't handle?
No, they walk on water.
Something that needs a feminine touch. His eyes shifted in a way that most people would have missed. They'd been together in their younger years, and she could still read him. A smile began to play at her lips.
No, not a feminine touch. You're into something too ugly for them. You're isolated.
Something like that. Her smile broadened, and she leaned back against the dash.
What's in it for me?
What do you want?
I want to go home to Italy.
And I want funding to start my own fashion line.
Cut the crap, Donatella. You know I can't do that. You can do anything.
The Mossad wants you dead.
You and Irene could take care of that with a phone call.
Yeah, but we can't take care of Hamas. Those guys really know how to hold a grudge. And we can't do anything about the enemies you made when you were working private. Try again.
Why don't you make me an offer?
Don't you want to know what the job is first?
Not really.
All right. New face, new identity. A nice condo in New York overlooking Central Park. You stay away from the fashion industry, but I bankroll you in an art gallery.
Art? She said.
It was something she'd never considered.
I like art.
I remember, he said, slipping his Glock into the holster beneath his arm. You used to drag me to those openings.
I thought you could use a little culture.
Apparently, it didn't take. Chapter 23 Tal Afar, Iraq. Anthony Staton moved along the shattered wall, finally getting a glimpse of his target in the moonlight. The building was constructed of concrete and had sustained a fair amount of damage from the war and ISIS's recent takeover of the city. The bottom floor was burned out, but the entire top floor had apparently been renovated into a luxury flat. It was hard to believe from where he was standing. Great care had been taken to leave no outward evidence that it was habitable, and blackout shades went down every afternoon just before sunset. Now that the agency had located it, there was nothing he would have liked better than to see the whole structure disappear in a pillar of flame. Paint it with a laser, wait for a drone to come overhead,
and then slink out of there in the ensuing dust and chaos. Unfortunately, that wasn't the plan. The former Iraqi general who had planted his fat ass in this cut-rate penthouse was apparently too important to vaporize. Irene Kennedy wanted him alive, and that left Staten wandering around ISIS-held streets with nothing more than a bare-bones team to back him up. Fast and light was undoubtedly the best strategy in this situation, but that didn't make him feel any less exposed. This was an op that he would have gladly let someone else handle, but the agency was an operational clusterfuck right now. Scott Coleman was damn near in a wheelchair, Joe Maslick had dug in his heels, and Mitch Rapp had hung up his Glock. Who would have thought he'd live long enough to see that last one happen? "This is Forward One," came a voice over his earpiece. "I'm in position. Still quiet. Looks like we might get lucky." Staten wondered. He couldn't help thinking of the cliché from the cheesy westerns he liked so much. Quiet. Too quiet. They hadn't wanted to move in when the streets were all but abandoned because the team would stand out too much. Instead, they'd picked a time of night early enough that there were still a few people wandering around, but late enough that they were more interested in getting home than asking questions. Still, pedestrian traffic was far lighter than he'd expected, and he'd only seen two patrols, both easily avoided. Either this was shaping up to be a cakewalk, or the other shoe was about to drop. In his experience, it was always the latter. There were no gifts in this life. He reached up and activated the throat mic hidden beneath his traditional garb. "I have eyes on the line, and I'm moving into position. Stay on your toes. I don't have a great feeling about this."
"You never do, Tony. Copy."
There was a clothesline that ran from the top of the target building to an abandoned one across the street. An advance team had managed to replace it with a Kevlar one that they swore looked and felt exactly the same. Staten had been skeptical, but judging by a pair of pants hanging from it, he'd been overly pessimistic. Three of his men would zip line across it to the roof. From there, they'd cut through the lock on the access door and slip down into Ferris Wazir's apartment. They'd pop the guards, dart the family, and then take the former general back across the line. The best they'd been able to come up with for getting him to a viable LZ was a wooden handcart, reasonably common in the area, but still risky. The whole thing, the zip line, the uncertain number of security men, the cart, was a little seat of the pants for his taste. Scott Coleman would have loved it, but Staten saw it as a fuck-up waiting to happen.
"Is everyone in position?" he asked.
The team confirmed.
"Then we're a go."
There was a lone man walking up the street in his direction, but Staten largely ignored him. He looked to be about 100 years old, hobbling forward with none of the urgency felt by the other people out at that time of night. He probably figured, at his age, screw ISIS. Above, a dark figure crossed the Kevlar line, moving quickly enough to be invisible to anyone not specifically looking. A second followed, and then a third. A voice crackled in his earpiece.
"We've gained the roof. Looks clear."
"Copy that," Staten said. "Go ahead and reposition the cable."
"On it,"
another voice responded. The end attached to the abandoned building would be moved down one floor to reverse the slope and give them an even faster ride on the way out. It made the landing a little tricky, particularly with the dead weight of Wazir, but it was worth it to reduce their exposure time.
"The lock is what we expected," one of his men said over the radio.
"It won't?" Staten ducked involuntarily at the sudden flash and deafening concussion of an explosion. It took him a moment to process the fact that the roof his men were on had been transformed into thousands of flaming concrete shards, arcing through the air. The old man in the road stopped, glancing back at the massive fireball, before continuing on his way as if nothing had happened.
"Pull back," Staten said into his throat mic. "I repeat, pull back!"
He ran forward, trying to figure out what the fuck had just happened. Did his men trip a booby trap? It seemed impossible. They were specifically looking for one and had instructions to tell him before they started cutting through the lock. Flashes of gunfire appeared in the building across from their target, precisely where his man handling the cable would be. Staten broke away from the wall at his back, sprinting north toward his remaining team. He'd made it only about 10 yards when more flashes lit up the road. He tried to pinpoint where the fire was coming from, but it was impossible. It was coming from everywhere, every window, every rooftop, every doorway. The old man went down, and Staten swerved right in a futile search for cover. The first round hit him in the new hip that everyone thought would retire him. After that, impacts started coming so fast, he couldn't distinguish them. The overwhelming sensation was of their momentum, shoving him sideways and finally slamming him to the ground. The darkness was gone now, driven away by thousands of muzzle flashes. He spotted the carcass of a car shimmering in the artificial light and tried to crawl to it. The force of the bullets impacting his back seemed to be pinning him to the ground, though, grinding him mercilessly into the dust. He squeezed the trigger of his own weapon, and the roar of it joined the rest, before everything went silent. Ali Nassar laid his phone on the limousine seat and allowed himself a rare smile. The king had called personally to express his gratitude for the reduction in anti-monarchy trolling on social media, still blissfully unaware that it was Sayed Halabi's doing. Further, the 5 million euros demanded by the mullah was at this moment being loaded onto Maya Zaman's private jet. He had provided half himself, while two other men loyal to Nassar had made up the balance. All of the arrangements were complete, and there was no reason to believe the transfer wouldn't go smoothly. Even the problem posed by Talal bin Musaid was showing signs of improvement. Reports were that he was on his way to Monaco to visit his brother. Having him outside of Saudi Arabia would be helpful, as Nassar had decided that the benefits of killing the prince now outweighed the drawbacks. While it was unlikely that President Alexander would have the courage to move against bin Musaid in a way that would jeopardize the precarious relationship between their two countries, it was conceivable that the CIA or Mossad would attempt an unauthorized rendition. And while all these developments were undoubtedly gifts from Allah, they were hardly sufficient to elicit a smile from a man unaccustomed to the expression. No, only the news of Mitch Rapp's resignation had the power to do that. The extent of the injuries suffered by the CIA man in Saudi Arabia were apparently far worse than the intelligence community had been told. A chime on his phone sounded, and he glanced down at it. An encrypted email from Irene Kennedy. He opened it and, instead of text, found only a link to an ISIS propaganda site. Intrigued, he clicked on it and waited for the video to load. When it began playing, he felt the breath catch in his chest. It was a slickly edited film of an attack on a small group of U.S. operatives. The location was immediately recognizable. Faris Wazir's home in Iraq. Nassar rewound it and watched again, his fist clenching around the phone as the roof blew off the top of Faris Wazir's apartment and gunfire erupted from every direction. The overhead shot zoomed onto a man running across the street, jerking wildly as he was impacted by what seemed like an infinite number of rounds. He finally fell, firing his own weapon uselessly into a stone wall before going still. The video then began quick cuts accompanied by loud revolutionary music. Dead Americans being carried from buildings, the barely recognizable remains of the ones from the roof being collected. A bloody corpse being dragged through the streets. He finally shut off the video and dialed a number Mullah Halabi had given him. He had never imagined he'd be forced to use it so soon, and in response to such crushing stupidity. Surprisingly, the ISIS leader picked up personally. "You're up late, Director."
I just saw the video of the raid on Ferris Wazir's home. Glorious, isn't it?
Glorious? Nassar said, glancing at the glass separating him from his driver, although we knew it was soundproof.
It's insanity. I gave you that information to allow Wazir to escape before the Americans arrived. Irene Kennedy just sent me an email with only the link to the video. No text at all. I can assure you that her lack of diplomacy was intended to make a point. To make it clear that she suspects that the leak came from my organization.
Yes, I imagine you're right.
Then why would you do this? Why would you jeopardize my position and my ability to provide you with intelligence?
Because you needed this, Ali.
What? I needed it?
You portray such strength, but inside you're weak. Of course you would say that you grew up poor. But in fact you lived the lifestyle of your family's wealthy benefactors and attended Oxford. And I'm aware of your military service. But your carefully planned operations were acts devoid of any real risk or passion. Now you feel the danger. You feel the Americans' eyes on you, the anxiety of wondering if one of their drones is circling you right now. Will they discover your betrayal? And if so, what action will they take?
If they kill me, all the money and intelligence I'm providing you will disappear. The king—
Halabi began to laugh, drowning out Nassar's words. I suspect you'll be fine, Ali, particularly now that the CIA is trying to deal with the departure of Mitch Rapp. But I'm not certain of it, and neither are you. You're now in a position that will test your faith in God. Will you pass that test? Are your actions in his service, or your own?
There was no point in fighting with the man. Nothing would come of it. I serve God.
Good, Ali. Good. And of course I sympathize with the difficulties the general has caused you. So, tell me, what is it I can do to balance the scales?
Nassar was both surprised and relieved by the offer. Already Halabi was beginning to understand his value and the importance of maintaining his loyalty.
Prince Talal bin Musaid is on his way to Monaco, Nassar said.
Ah, can I assume that his usefulness to you is at an end, and that you're concerned about the risks of dealing with him yourself?
Yes.
Then I'll contact my people in Europe and have the matter put to rest.
Chapter 24. East of Juba, South Sudan. This sucked. No, that was the understatement of the century. This had catastrophe written all over it, in blood, 10 feet high. Kent Black's foot suddenly felt too weak to depress the accelerator, and he let the truck's speedometer drift. Outside, dust was enveloping the vehicle, confining him to the suffocating heat of the closed-up cab. The road he was on was little worse than a tracked-up strip in an endless plain of sun-baked dirt. His GPS said he was headed in the right direction and kept counting down to his arrival. But he wasn't sure that was a good thing. He despised South Sudan. When he'd been an army sniper, he'd spent a lot of time fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. But that had been different. Sure, both countries were dry, dusty shitholes. But at least he'd had backup and a few geographic features to hide behind. The empty landscape he was penetrating into had a hazy, overexposed photograph feel that Black found disorienting. Undoubtedly why Karim had chosen it as the location for their meeting. Arms dealing had never been high on his list of careers. But what choice did he have? His lucrative job as a $5,000 suit-wearing, supermodel dating contract killer had recently run into an impassable roadblock named Mitch Rapp. Their business together had ended with Rapp agreeing not to kill him, but making it clear that the next time they met, the outcome would be different. So Black had grabbed a map and searched for corners of the world that were both remote and in need of a man of his talents. South Sudan, which was teetering in and out of civil war, seemed to fit the bill. He figured he'd do a little mercenary work for the government while Rapp forgot about him. Unfortunately, the government proved to be only slightly less crazy than the rebel forces it was fighting. In the end, supplying both sides from way behind battle lines turned out to be not only more lucrative, but a hell of a lot safer. Until now. Karim was the most psychotic of the rebel leaders he dealt with. A guy who would set a man on fire for putting too much cream in his coffee. If human history taught any consistent lesson, though, it was that the biggest psycho usually came out on top. So while their relationship had a lot of potential upside, it was also extremely precarious. Which was why Black always had one of his lackeys make the physical deliveries. Again, until now. Yesterday, Karim had requested that Black be personally involved in their transaction. A shipment of surplus AKs and a few RPGs that were as likely to blow up the person using them as the people they were aimed at. The question was why? To reward him for his service to the cause? Probably not. To cut him up with a chainsaw? A better bet. It wouldn't be the first time one of the rebel leader's suppliers ended up in pieces. A line of military vehicles, all supplied at a tidy profit by him, appeared on the horizon. He accelerated to a more confident pace, finally skidding to a stop in front of the rebel contingent and throwing open the door. "General," he said, using the title the man had given himself, "it's great to see you. How's the war going?" Karim was a disconcertingly large man with deep black skin setting off eyes that had turned a bit yellow. One tracked reasonably well, while the other wandered a bit, the result of a childhood head injury, apparently. "Have you brought the weapons?"
"Of course."
"They're good?"
"They're okay."
Karim nodded. He'd never been all that concerned with a few guns failing or exploding in his soldiers' faces. Men were cheap. Weapons were expensive. Black scanned the faces of the rebels surrounding him with an easy smile. Some were sitting on the burning hot hoods of their vehicles, while others milled around eyeing him. There were around 20 in all. Probably a third were either drunk or on something. All were armed. If things went south, he was definitely going to be killed by a bullet that he'd overcharged these assholes for. Before that happened, though, he'd punch a few holes in General Douchebag's head. While close contact fighting wasn't Black's specialty, it didn't have to be. All he had to do was draw and pull the trigger before one of Kareem's inebriated minions could figure out how to get his rifle off his shoulder. "It's my understanding that you're selling weapons to my enemies," Karim said. His face was a lifeless mask, like one of those Old West bandits propped up in his coffin. It was fucking unnerving.
"I don't know what you're talking about," Black lied.
"Who told you that?"
"One of my men. He used to fight for Abdo, and he says you are providing him with equipment."
"Wait a minute now. You and Abdo are allies," Black said. It had been true up until about a month ago, but that alliance had fallen apart over something even his troops didn't fully have a handle on. No one could blame an American new to the area for not being able to keep up with the ever-shifting landscape of African rebellion. At least, that's what Black hoped. Karim stared at him for a few seconds, and then began reaching for his waistband. Black swatted at an imaginary fly in order to get his hand next to the Beretta he had stuffed in his waistband.
It turned out to be unnecessary. The African just pulled out a small leather pouch containing a diamond nearly the size of a golf ball. 2 minutes later, Black was standing in a cloud of dust with that stone safely in his pocket. He leaned against the jeep he'd been left, watching the truck full of weapons struggle to keep up with the general's motorcade. The cold sweat of fear turned into the hot sweat of being stuck in the desert, with nothing but a piece of shit jeep and a pair of flip-flops for transportation. Fucking Mitch Rapp. The rebel jeep was still holding together as Black crossed the White Nile and headed into Juba. After hours of nothing but dust and rock, the landscape turned green, with majestic trees and tended fields dotting the landscape. Not that any of those things were easy to make out. The on-again, off-again civil war had done a job on the city's power infrastructure, leaving it in a permanent gloom. He had to rely on his one working headlight to navigate the roads, weaving through pedestrians, bicycles, and the occasional farm animal. Finally, he turned onto a quiet street that dead-ended into an old church. Its faded yellow walls were still structurally sound, as was most of the roof. But that was about it. The windows were boarded up, the steeple was listing badly, and the cross that had once topped the bell tower was lying broken by the perimeter wall. It wasn't much, but it was home. He pushed a button on the remote in his pocket, and the heavy doors that once welcomed the city's Christians opened enough to allow him to drive inside. He parked the jeep amidst the overturned pews and headed for his living quarters at the back. The crates that he normally would have had to navigate were conspicuously absent. The sale to Karim had wiped him out of merchandise, and he'd need to sell the diamond to his fence in New York before he could bring in any more. On the bright side, his demonstrable lack of inventory would give him time to figure out what he was going to do about his client list. The under-the-table sales to the government still seemed safe. But the situation with Abdo was tricky. The problem was that while Abdo was far stupider than Karim, he was just as vicious. He wasn't going to just sit quietly by while his weapons supply dried up. Best to consider the problem with the assistance of a few of the beers he kept stashed in the fridge behind his desk. Hopefully the power had been on all afternoon. There was nothing worse than getting back from nearly being dismembered only to find a fridge full of warm brew. He pushed through the door, but then froze when he saw a man sitting at his desk. He had a dark complexion beneath shaggy hair and a slightly more presentable beard. It didn't take long for recognition to kick in. Black spun and sprinted back into the nave, leaping what was left of the altar before spotting the shadow of someone in his path. He tried to get around it, but without being quite sure how it happened, his feet were taken out from under him and he found himself rolling uncontrollably across the rubble-strewn floor. He was about to get up and start running again when a woman slipped a blade under his chin. Where the hell had she come from? The bitch was wearing white pants and a blouse that was completely free of dust and sweat stains. How was that even possible? She stared down at him with her dark hair hanging down on either side of his face. Black usually went for girls who were young and easy to impress. But this woman was gorgeous. Her age was impossible to determine. The athletic shape looked late 20s. But the face had a few subtle lines that suggested early 40s. He heard footsteps and tried to spot the approaching man without causing the blade to cut into his throat. Finally, he came into view, looking down at Black with an expression of vague disappointment.
Mitch! Come on, man. Don't let me get killed by a chick, especially one this hot.
The woman eased the pressure of the blade against his skin and looked up at Rapp.
I like him.
This is the best you could do? Arms dealing to both sides in a civil war? Rapp dropped behind Black's desk again and fished a beer from the refrigerator.
Come on, man. You said to stay out of your way.
How much more out of your way can I get? I'm off the edge of the fucking earth.
It was hard to argue. The kid could follow instructions. Have a seat, Kent. He did as he was told, looking a little hopeful at Rapp